We got Randy and Janet and Fulton and the Edomite and Donnie and Mark and myself.
Wonderful.
And Fulton brought a big fine meal, and we ate partake. Some still eating, and we got a just doing good. You know, we think we're white.
Okay, so how's it going?
Well, it's going.
I'd ask Janet how she likes Louisiana, but of course she's going to say that she loves it with y'all sitting there, so I'm not going to ask.
Don't speak her mind.
Well, it's wonderful. Yeah, I like it. It's rural. It's a rural area out of the city.
Yeah, that's any rural area is better than the city.
Absolutely. And it's all white.
No. Yeah, I've been trying to find her a nigger companion, but there's none that live around here close, so... We don't even have any Mexicans that live around here close either, so
she's better off with the crocodile than the nigger.
Yeah.
Got enough of that back home. Packy.
She's put up with me this long, and she hadn't hurt me yet, so I guess we're gonna make it.
Good. Good.
What's going on with you?
I'm busy as usual.
News or anything good to report?
Not a damn thing. I'm trying to, my next move is to get my Saxon Messenger out in the mail for this month. I got to proofread it real quick.
Did you get the disc that had the Mein Kampf on it?
Yes, I did, and I hate to disappoint you, but...
It's only the first part?
It's the same 79 MP3s I got up on my website.
Oh, I hate that. Lord, goodness.
Gerald, you should have known that.
Well, you know, I'm not perfect.
Anyway. It's the same Mein Kampf PDF on it I got up on my website.
Okay. Well, I'm sorry. I tried.
It ain't your fault.
It's got to be his fault.
There's another PDF there of another document I got on my website. It's Hitler and Gun Control by V.S. Harrell, right? Or not by V.S. Harrell, by William Pierce. It's like the guy got the files off my website, put them on a CD, I swear.
Oh.
Yeah, you know, all those files aren't original to my site, but they're the only place I know where they're all in the same place, right?
Yeah. Well, I've been trying to get a hold of Seth to make a decision about the websites, and I think he's ignoring me, so I'm going to have to do something pretty quick about him, because I'm not going to keep him. I'm not going to keep the domain name. And if he's not going to change him over, he said he wanted him and wanted to do it. And he did all the work on them, and that would be the logical thing. But he may not want to pay that little bit every 3 months to keep the name current.
$10 a month? That's terrible.
Huh?
$10 a month? That's terrible.
Very much, but I don't know. I'm going to give him one last try, and if he doesn't respond, then, they're available.
Well, I'll take them both, right?
Yeah, I know. We talked about it.
I don't want them to go away, right? I really don't.
Well, Sarah said he didn't either. He said he really wanted them, but I can't get him to do anything about it. So
I just took on one of the biggest Hitler sites on the internet because the guy can't he can't pay for it, and his host dropped him. His ISP dropped him.
And you got it?
Yeah, it's on my server right now. It's nseuropa.org. I'm waiting for the DNS to change. It should change soon, and I'll be hosting that. You'll see an announcement on the front of my Mein Kampf site. It's his site. I gave him an FTP account to manage it, but I'm hosting it, and I'll have a copy of the files, right? So if anything ever happens to him, that site will, as long as my heart's beating, that site will be up, right?
Well, is it an old site, or...?
Oh yeah, it's a heavily trafficked site.
Okay.
It gets more visitors than my Mein Kampf site. I know that.
Yeah.
It doesn't get more visitors than Christigenia, but.
Well, that's that's good. I'm glad to see them. Well, does anybody have anything they want to comment on or say before we start?
I got a question.
Uh-oh.
Bill, was Jesus crucified on a cross or a stake?
Well, what does it matter? Yeah, you know, the Greek word staros, right? Staurus. That describes a stake, but that doesn't mean that he didn't have a cross piece, right? Because a staurus is not a stake in the sense that it's a straight piece of wood. A staurus is a stake in the sense that it's something that stood up in the ground. It's fixed into the ground. That's why it's called a staurus. Okay? A staurus does not necessitate that it's one piece of wood without a cross piece. Idiots picture the tent stakes that we have, and they insist that that's what the staurus is. But that's not why it's called a staurus. It's only called a staurus because the word is a noun that comes from a verb, stayrizo, and stayrizo is the same word we get the English word stay from. It describes something that's stuck in the ground, period. It could be a cross, it could be a letter Z. If you pound it into the ground, it's a staurus, right? Period. Now from the earliest times, when this word was translated into Latin, the Latin word for a cross was used. Yeah, you know, a crucis. Now the Greeks had other words for a straight stake, okay? That described a straight stake. Charax is one of them. And that's, you know, the Greeks had other words for a straight stake that they could have very easily used. But from the very beginning, it was translated into the Latin crux or crucix, from which we get crucifix, right? And that's a stake with a cross piece. It always is. Now, whether it was T-shaped or cross-shaped as we know it is immaterial. We don't know. A lot of people insist that it was T-shaped. They aren't necessarily wrong, but they aren't necessarily right.
I thought the Catholics was one that started the cross idea.
Well, no, because there's Latin versions of the scriptures that go way back before the Catholic Church. And where you see that word staurus in Greek, you'll see the Latin word for a cross. And a staurus does not insist that it was only a stake. It just doesn't. Because the word staurus simply means something stuck in the ground. That's all it means.
Okay.
It could be a cross shape. It could be a T shape. It could be a straight stick. But in any event, it could be called a staurus. But from the very earliest times, the Latin word crux, what was used, crux, and crucis, crucis, to describe what Christ was hung on, and those Latin manuscripts, they predate the Roman, the official Roman Church, right? They predate by 5 centuries, right?
He was talking about it was a stake, but it was done by Bullinger.
Yeah, well, he's full of shit, too. The Greek word staurus means something stuck in the ground. It means stake in that sense. It doesn't mean stake in the sense that we use, like a tent stake is a straight, a straight rod, with a little hook in the top, and we call that a stake. Well, the Greeks had other words for that, and the most popular was charax. But which we would spell charax, and that's the word that I believe that we get the word for carrot from. And I think that the English word for carrot and the Greek word charax both come from a Hebrew word that describes a stake as a straight pointed stick. But, if it was a straight pointed stick, and that's the word, the apostles wanted to relate that, they'd have used that word. They wouldn't have used staris.
Well, if it had been a straight stick, Christ wouldn't have lived as long as he did, because he would have died fairly quickly because he couldn't have breathed if they'd hung his arms up over his head.
Yeah, I don't know the issues of physiognomy, right? I've heard that argument, but I believe it probably was it probably had a cross piece. Whether it had the cross piece, down from the tip, so it would look like the traditional cross, or whether it had the cross piece at the top, so that it really looked like a tau or a letter T. I think that's immaterial, right?
A cross comes from the paganism. They go way back in history and show where it was come from, pagan belief before Christ.
Now, you know something? There was the Greek ankh, A-N-K-H, that was a cross-shaped looking thing, but I think that really represented a key, right?
Yeah.
And not a cross. Now there was the fact is that where the gospel says that Pilate, that Christ said he was going to be killed by the Romans, and in that manner he indicated which way he was going to die. And the gospel says that. And that intones that because he was going to be killed by the Romans, at the hand of the Romans, that intones that he was going to be crucified, because the Romans were using crucifixion as a form of execution at that time. The Judeans did not use crucifixion. They used stoning to execute people. Now, it goes all the way back to the time of the Persians. Herodotus talks about the Persians crucifying people on a cross like that. And we know that the Assyrians did it too, and we know that from inscriptions, that they crucified people on a cross like that. So it's an ancient form of execution, right? It ain't nothing new. It's not anything unique to the time of Christ.
One of the things, too, when Yahshua was condemned, he was to bear the cross to Calvary, and you would think that, once a person's been condemned and beaten, that they wouldn't be likely to carry a pole big enough to hang them vertically on. It was probably maybe the cross member that he was to carry up there. It also make a lot more sense to have a cross member on it just simply for logistics of putting it up there, hanging him up there and all. If you had him on to a cross member to start with, it might be.
Right.
But, like I said, it don't prove anything either.
Yeah, but I saw in a movie, I saw that nigger run up there and grab that cross and carry it up that hill for Christ. So it had to be a cross. That. I forgot which movie it was in, but I'm sure that happened.
It also says, cursed is every man that hangs upon a tree, and that was a fulfillment of that prophecy, right?
Of course, the cross could have had a little wheel on it, like you guys drag around down
here. Like they carry their overnight bag.
Okay, anybody, anything else, or? You have another thought, Don, or was that the only one you had this week?
Oh, okay. I'm working on my computer all week.
Oh, okay.
Messed up on my navigator here. Well, Bill, Eli was defending his 2012 prophecy today, was he not?
Was he? I don't know.
Oh, you didn't get a copy?
No. Eli's a joker, right? He's a joker for a man. He's an antichrist. I mean, if Christ says no man knows the day, and you claim to know the day, well, then you're being an antichrist.
Well,
yeah, 2 years ago, Eli said that.
Everybody else had,
I didn't
2 years ago, when the Gulf Stream thing was a big worry, Eli sat on that radio on that restoration hour, and he said that Europe was going to be in a deep freeze and hundreds and thousands of people were going to die. That's what he said, and it never happened. Now, I got a recording. It's on john844.org, and I didn't put it there, but somebody else put it there, of Eli James on the Waterman program on Argusug Radio telling people back in September or August or whenever the hell, it wasn't long before November, that Elenin was Nibiru and that it was going to cause major catastrophic damage to the planet and that he had a cave in southern Illinois to go hide in. That's what he said. It's on the recording. It's Eli. There's no doubt. Yet, you know, this man is a false prophet. He's just another Hal Lindsey ass clown, and he's got all these turkeys fooled that he's Christian identity when he's a damn universalist.
What did they say about 2012?
Oh, December 21st, 2012 is the end of the world. That's it. We're done.
Yeah.
All part of that. Yeah.
Well, wait, if that was true, how come them so much had disappeared before? They all gone, isn't it?
He talks about the fifth Mayan prophecy and the Biru.
They all died. You know, so we need to see what day that was. That's when they all, it's for them. They all shag ass. They died before them.
The bottom line is he needs to be driven out of Christian identity. That's what he needs. But as long as there's clowns like Alan Truitt that entertain him.
I think he could have been a sword or.
What'd you say about Alan Truitt?
I said Eli James needs to be driven out of Christian identity, but as long as there's clowns like Alan Truitt that'll suck his ass, then we're gonna have to deal with Eli James.
Alan Truitt, I blocked him.
All right, are we ready now to get on with the study, or
sure?
Somebody else got something else they want to bring up? Or
Bill, is the ostrich a clean or unclean animal?
Yeah, you know, there were no ostriches in Palestine or anywhere in the Near East that could be listed in the Bible, right? To be considered. So we don't know from the script text in the Bible. We will never find out from the biblical text, right, about ostriches and emus. But I think what we have to do is look at the pattern. Yeah, you know, is it a bird of prey? Does it eat carrion? Yeah, you know, things like that. And if it fits the pattern that those forbidden fowls fit, then we probably shouldn't eat it, right?
Well, I guess the Jews consider it unclean, but what I was reading on the internet.
Yeah, I don't. Yeah, you know, the Jews, I really don't care. I would look at the other birds and look at the habits of the ostrich and see if it does what those unclean birds do.
Plus, a chicken will eat different things, but it has two stomachs to cleanse the food, does it not?
Well, right, but do chickens really eat dead animals? I don't know.
They'll eat things they probably shouldn't eat, but they've got a filtering system in their intestines to clean that, where
right.
Some animals do not.
And goats eat things they shouldn't eat too.
But
goats are clean. But eagles and vultures and things like that they're unclean for a reason, right? And I would have to examine that and see why the ostrich, you know, what the ostrich does and what its physiognomy is like before I decided whether or not I should eat it.
Well, I guess I know in my version it's not listed in the Bible, but.
I would think they'd be clean. I don't know what an ostrich would do to make it unclean.
The article was saying that, you know, today they chew the cud, but they possibly had evolved from something that didn't chew the cud.
I tell you, one sure way. No.
well, that evolved word should be left out of all biblical consideration, right?
If you can't find out, leave it alone.
Well, I guess you can eat ostrich then.
What about a duck, Bill? A duck.
Yeah, you know, there's a bird called a swan in the Bible, but I don't believe that that the original bird really is a swan, right?
Well, I would think geese and ducks and swan, all of those are clean.
A lot of people think that those webbed feet birds are unclean, and they only think that because there's a bird in the Bible. That's called a swan. in the King James. But I'm not sure if that original bird really is a swan.
I thought a signifying feature was the red feet.
Yeah, but there's nothing about web feet in the Bible.
I'm a Bill. It says, I think those birds of prey, you know, that have to kill and eat meat, and, you know, as opposed to.
Yeah, my version doesn't list on, so it's calling it something else.
Well, right, but a lot of people will take that there's, I don't find anything about web feed. I almost went for it. I fell for this once, right? And I looked into it, and I can't find anything about web-footed birds in the Bible. But what I discovered, and the reason why I fell for it at one time, what was because the swan is listed as an unclean food in the Bible, there are people that extend that to all webbed-footed birds, right? But the basic truth is that this thing that they call the swan in the King James Bible, we don't know if that was a swan. I think they just guessed. I'm being honest. We don't know. There's no way to tell that bird in Leviticus 11:18 is actually a swan. So how could you say that all the web-footed birds are unclean because this might be a swan? That's just
a lot of birds out there.
That's just silly. It can't be substantiated. Not academically. So I don't, you know something? I don't know. I ate geese when I was a kid. You know, I got an aunt in Massachusetts, raises her own geese, and she slaughters them, and she eats them during the winter. And I've known a lot of people in rural areas that do that. But I don't see a problem with eating goose because I don't see where web-footed birds are actually excluded. But people believe web-footed birds are excluded because it says swan at Leviticus 11:18. I can't find another biblical reason why they might be excluded. I might be wrong, you know, but I can't find it.
What it says in the Septuagint.
At Leviticus 11:18, what does it say in the Septuagint?
A lot of duck hunters and eaters out there. It's going to be.
It says the red bill, and what we have is a word perforiona, and a perforiona is. I have no idea. Perforiona describes something that's purple, right? That's what it does, because perforis is the Greek word for purple, right? Now let me see what Liddell and Scott have at perforiona. Oh, you know something? I'm in the wrong verse. That's horned owl. Oh no, that's horned owl in the ASV, and it's swan in the King James. It's perforiona in the Greek, right?
Horned owl.
A red bill. I'm going to look it up. It's going to take me a second. I'm in my Greek lexicon now. Perforiona.
And the MSS translated it wrong.
Perforiona. What the hell? Perforiona. Now, this bird, this book says that the perfora is a water hen. And in Old Father, C.H. Old Father, in his edition of Diodorus Siculus, I got this right here. I made this note out of my copy of Diodorus Siculus, says that it's a purple coot. Now, whatever the hell a purple coot is, I don't.
We have coots here in Louisiana.
We have what we call coots.
Well, but they don't. Be the same
thing. right. It may not be the same thing. And this perfora, it says water hen as Aristotle used the word, but who knows what the hell he was referring to by a water hen. And if it's purple, then it sure as hell ain't a swan. It might be a damn peacock for all I know. I don't know. Yeah, you know, some of these birds, yeah, you know, we have to come to a a conclusion by what we observe in nature as yet, you know, and see what these birds do, because we can't tell these birds apart. The chicken might be outlawed here. Then we'd all be screwed, or at least, you know, most of us that eat chicken. We all eat chicken.
You Yankees eat chicken?
Yeah, we eat chicken. All the niggers we got, there's KFC all over the place. Nah, I'm kidding. I don't eat KFC, but yeah, I eat chicken.
Well, we're going to feed you chicken when you get down here.
We're turnip greens.
Yeah, right. It'll probably be crocodile. Tastes like chicken. It all does. Rattlesnake.
We're going to feed you some snipe.
Well, yeah, these birds, this swan isn't any swan, right?
But you have to go out and catch him yourself.
And I really believe, Mark, that that's why a lot of people, even in identity, say that you can't eat web-footed birds, because this says swan. But who's this ain't no swan. It's purple. I never saw a purple swan. at least the Septuagint translators thought it was purple. Even the Enhanced Strong Lexicon, they just have an unclean animal of some kind. They don't know what the hell it is. The original Strong says perhaps the ibis, water hen, a species of owl, a barn owl, an unclean lizard, perhaps the chameleon. He doesn't know his ass from his elbow either. Why didn't he just say, I don't know?
Range that far
apart.
It'd be a bird owl.
Maybe the lizard used to fly.
All right, who wants to start on chapter 11?
Is that where we're at, chapter 11?
Yeah, that's what.
Wow.
Is that Randy? No.
Pretty sure we got 2 teams.
Yeah. Okay. Who wants to do the honors starting off? Everybody raise your hand.
I'll jump in there. You want me to?
No worries.
Okay. Clear my throat. Chapter 11. Then all Israel gathered themselves to David unto Hebron, saying, Behold, we are thy foe in thy flesh. Moreover, in time past, even when Saul was king, thou wast he that leddest out and brought us in Israel. For thy God said unto thee, Thou shalt feed my people Israel, and thou shalt be ruler over my people Israel. Therefore came all the elders of Israel to the king of Hebron, and David made a covenant with them in Hebron before the Lord, and they anointed David king over Israel, according to the word of the Lord by Samuel. David and all Israel went to Jerusalem, which is Jebus, where the Jebusites were the inhabitants of the land. The inhabitants of Jebus said to David, Thou shalt not come hither. Nevertheless, David took the castle of Zion, which is the city of David. David said, Whosoever smiteth the Jebusites first shall be chief and captain. Joab, the son of Zeruiah, went first up and was chief. David dwelt in the castle. Therefore they called it the city of David. He built the city round about, even from Milo round about, and Joab repaired the rest of the city. David waxed greater and greater, for the Lord of hosts was with him. These are also the chief of the mighty men whom David had, who strengthened themselves with him in his kingdom, and with all Israel, to make him king according to the word of the Lord, concerning Israel. This is the number of the mighty men whom David had. Special being and Hakamanite and chief of the captains. He lifted up his spear against 300 slain by him at one time. And after him was Eleazar, son of Dodo, the Ahohite, who was one of the three mighty. He was with David at Pasdamim, and there were the Philistines were gathered together to battle. Where was a parcel of ground full of barley, and the people fled from before the Philistines? They set themselves in the midst of that parcel and delivered it to the Philistines, and the Lord saved them by a great deliverance. Now three of the 30 captains went down to the rock to David, into the cave of Adullam, and the host of the Philistines encamped in the valley of Rephaim. David was then in the hold, and the Philistines' garrison was then at Bethlehem. David longed and said, "Oh, that one would give me drink of the water of the well of Bethlehem, that is at the gate." He broke through the host of the Philistines and drew water out of the well of Bethlehem. That was by the gate, and took it and brought it to David. But David would not drink of it, but poured it out to the Lord, and said, "My God forbid it for me that I should do this thing. Shall I drink the blood of these men that have put their lives in jeopardy? For with the jeopardy of their lives they brought it." Therefore he would not drink it. These things did these three mightiest. Ishai, the brother of Joab, he was the chief of the three. For lifting up his spear against 300, he slew them, and had a name among the three. Of the three, he was more honorable than the two, for he was their captain. Howbeit, he attained not to the first three. Aiah, the son of Jehoiada, the son of valiant man of Kabzeel, who had done many acts. He slew two lion-like men of Moab. Also, he went down and slew a lion in a pit in a snowy day. An Egyptian, a man of great stature, 5 cubits high, in the Egyptian's hand was a spear like a weaver's beam. He went down to him with a staff, plucked the spear out of the Egyptian's hand, and slew him with his own spear. These things did Benaiah, the son of Jehoiada, and had the name among the three mighties. Oh, he was honorable among the 30, but attained not to the first three, and David set him over his guard. Also the valiant men of the armies were Asahel, the brother of Joab, Elhanan, the son of Dodo, of Bethlehem, Shammah the Harite, Pelus the Pelonite, Ari the son of Ikish, the Tekoite, Abazir, and Antithite. Sibekai, the Hushathite, well, that's a tough one. Hai, the Aholite, Briah, Netophathite, Heled, the son of Banah, the Netophathite, Ephi, the son of Rabbi of Gibeah, that pertained to the children of Benjamin, Benaiah the Parathite, Uriah of the Brooks of Gash, Abiel the Arbathite, Asmaveth, Aramite, Eliba the Shalbanite, the sons of Hashem, Gizanite, the Jonathan the son of Shag the Harite, Ahim, the son of Sakar, the Harite, Eliphal, the son of Ur, Hefer, the Mekarothite, Ahat, Ijah, the Pelonite, Ezra, the Carmelite, Ari, the son of Esbai, Joel, the brother of Nathan, Mibar, the son of Hagarai, Balak, the Ammonite, Nahari, the Barathite, Armbearer of Joab, the son of Zariah, Ari the Arathite, Ethrite, Arab the Ethrite, Aiah the Hittite, Zabad the son of Ahlai, Adina the son of Shiza, the Reubenite, a captain of the Reubenites, and 30 with him. Am the son of Micah, the Josephat, the Mithonite. The Ashtarothite, Shammah and Jehiel, the sons of Hotham, the Arite, Judael, the son of Shimri,
Calhoun, his brother, the Tezite, Hillel, Ahavite, and Jerubai, Bashavai, the sons of Elon, Elnam, and Isma, the Moabite, Eliel, and Obed, and Jophiel, the Mesobite.
Take a deep breath.
Tongue twisters there, boy, I'm telling you.
Wow. Now, these are David's mighty men, right? And we see, you know, this is what we have, the book of Joshua and the division of the land isn't 40 years in the desert, and another 50 years later, all the land of Israel is divided up among the tribes. Within 50 years, they're inhabiting all this land. And that's probably a long time. That's probably a liberal estimate. And we see they dwelt in the land of Moab. We see they dwelt in all these places. And then we see this list of David's mighty men. And it's so easy for people to want to believe, because that they subscribe to this universalism, that this man had to be a Hittite. And this man had to be a Moabite. So that this is a nice multicultural little world, and David's a damned hypocrite. And what we see is 450 years from the time of Joshua and the conquest of Canaan to the time of David rising to be the king. Well, all these people are Israelites who are merely being described by their geographical origination. And that's the trap we always fall into. They're not yet, you know, some of these men are described by their tribes, but most of them are being described by what town in Israel they came from or what district. And they're all Israelites. There's no doubt. David's not a hypocrite. We can't imagine David is a hypocrite because we want to fulfill some kind of multicultural agenda, but that's what mainstream pastors do. They make the presumption that David's a hypocrite and all these people must be Canaanites and Moabites. And it's important to defend the fact that all these men had to be Israelites, or they wouldn't have been among David's mighty men. Notice the Valley of the Rephaim is mentioned in verse 15, right? That's the giants, right? A lot of those were going to be slain, and that's described in Chronicles. But Goliath was a Rephaim. The Egyptian David killed, it is 7.5 feet tall, at least. 5 cubits tall. The short cubit is 7.5 feet, 5 cubits. The royal cubit, and he'd be about 9 feet tall. So that Egyptian's probably a Rephaim too, right? Because normal men aren't 7.5 feet tall. Not at this time.
You know, a lot of times these tall people that we see today, they're tall and slender, but you think back then they probably had a lot of body mass. I mean, they were 9 feet tall, but they were probably well developed.
Well, if you're going to be a warrior, you know, if you're, I can't, you know, speak for the ancient Hebrew warriors for what these men, what kind of equipment they had, but I could imagine that these men had to have the same equipment roughly that the Greek hoplites had, which means a man had to be able to carry 150 pounds of equipment into battle, right? Yet you're carrying your spears, your shield. The shields are heavy. Your swords. Yet you have your food. You have other accoutrements with you that you have to carry, and armor, and all that stuff. When you take it all off and put it on a scale, it's going to be pretty heavy. That they used. Yet, you know, they didn't always have iron. They used heavy leather shields, which maybe had a thinner metal coating on the outside of it. They used heavy leather breastplates and clothing, and the typical warrior probably had at least 100 pounds of equipment.
Well, you know, anybody today 7 foot tall, they put a basketball in his hand, and those guys were normally pretty slender. And
not well developed, I guess, in a lot of cases.
Well, in a lot of cases, right. But in other cases, like that Negro freak Shaquille O'Neal, right, that they're 7 foot tall and weigh 350 pounds. No, I imagine these people were pretty stout fellows, or they wouldn't have been warriors. They wouldn't have been able to hold up to it. Yeah, you know, a 7 foot tall string bean isn't going to make it carrying 100 pounds of equipment and running into battle. It's just not going to happen. But these are probably that these are all Rephaim, 5 cubits tall. He's probably one of the Rephaim. Goliath was what, 6 cubits tall, right? And that's like 9 feet by the short cubit.
I don't think Goliath was as skinny.
I was like 5 foot tall on a fourth leg.
Yeah, they probably weighed 400 pounds. I'm sure.
What's impressive to me is not all of these guys they were going up against, but the fearlessness of the Israelites here. You know, you got guys who take a spear and go salute, you know, slay 300 guys. You know, David, he stole, you know, I think 100 foreskins. He does that it? Man, he went out and he even done it, you know. And you got guys here, you know, David says, well, sure, like I drink water out of that well down there. You know, they go in there and wipe out a bunch of Philistines and bring back a bucket of water, you know. These guys are apparently not afraid of anything. And yet,
even
with the fearlessness they have, the amount of self-discipline that they had when they were with David and saw what Saul was trying to do and that David kept holding them back, keeping them from killing Saul, because there were several of these guys that, you know, they couldn't understand why David wouldn't go ahead and, you know, take Saul out. They want it too bad. And you got guys here that are, you know, that are not afraid to walk into 300 guys and, with a spear and kill them all. And yet they have this discipline, or at least enough respect for David, that they're willing to honor his wishes in this case.
Well, David he must have been, you know, he wrote all of those Psalms, and he wrote a lot of those Psalms while he was in flight from Saul. While he was taking harbor with the Philistines, he wrote a lot of those Psalms. And they had to be spread around, right? And David's attitude was that if he had the promise from God, that then he should just stand back and let God fulfill that promise. And that way, yeah, you know, that way a man's not deceiving himself, right? I mean, I might think I have some kind of commission from God and then try to use my own energy to affect that commission. And in the end, I'm just deceiving myself and I end up dead, right? Yeah, you know what I mean? And that's David believed that he had that commission from God and stood back and let God show that it be fulfilled. And that's the display of faith. And yet, you know, the abilities that these men had, are the underlying thread is that if we all had at any given time submitted ourselves to the will of God and worked to establish our kindred and our nation like these men were doing, then they can't be stopped. Then they can't be stopped. They had that commission from God, and they sought to do His work, and they couldn't be stopped.
But there was no fear. It was respect to Yahweh and what He had told him. But as far as, you know, you're talking about a guy who was a teenager, stepped out there, and Goliath went to hollering about it. You know, he said, well, I'll feed you gizzard to the buzzard before the day's out, bud. You know, so, I mean, you know, even though he had this discipline and he still was...
It's what he said about Yahweh that picked him up.
Yeah, that's right. He said, you know, it's just impressive to me how these guys, the fearlessness they had.
It comes all the way down through the Israelite people. That's what we've lost today. We've been feminized.
Yeah.
Look at Judah when they messed with them boy's sister.
Yeah. Oh,
how did they feel?
And they were pretty tricky about it.
Yeah. They fell for the deal.
They kind of edged their bit, didn't they?
I'm surprised that y'all are supposed to love everybody.
Well, you can love them when you kill them.
Maybe we ought to try some of them now. Y'all want to be in the license. Instead of baptism, we ought to try. It ends in ism, doesn't it?
Yeah, it is.
We use ism, circumcision. Instead of baptism.
All right, he wants to do chapter 12.
These were the men who came to David at Ziklag while he was banished from the presence of Saul, son of Kish. They were among the warriors who helped him in battle. They were armed with bows and were able to shoot arrows or to sling stones right-handed or left-handed. They were kinsmen of Saul from the tribe of Benjamin. Ezer, their chief, and Joash, the sons of Shema and the Gibeathite, Gazer and Pilat, the sons of Asmapheth, Merek, Jehu, the Hite, and the Gibeonite, a mighty man among the 30, who was a leader of the 30, Jeremiah, Jehizel, Johanan, Jozabad, Keterothite, Eluzia, Arimoth, Eli, Maria, and the Hite, Elkanai, Ishiah, Azarel, Joazer, and Jehoshabim, the Korathites, and Joelah, and Zedabiah, the sons of Jeram from Gedor. Some Gadites defected to David as told in the desert. They were brave warriors ready for battle and able to handle the shield and spear. Their faces were the faces of lions, and they were swift as gazelles in the mountains. Ezer was the chief, Iah the second in command, Elib the third, Ismanah the fourth, Jeremiah the fifth, Iah the sixth, Eliel the seventh, Johanan the eighth, Elzabad the ninth, Jeremiah the tenth, and Macbani the 11th. These Gadites were army commanders. The least was a match for 100, and the greatest for 1,000. It was they who crossed the Jordan in the first month when it was overflowing all its banks. And they put to flight everyone living in the valleys to the east and to the west. Other Benjamites and some men from Judah also came to David in his stronghold. David went out to meet them and said to them, if you have come to me in peace to help me, I am ready to have you unite with me. But if you have come to betray me to my enemies when my hands are free from violence, God of our fathers, see it and judge you. And the Spirit came upon the chief of the 30, and he said, we are yours, O David. We are with you, O son of Jesse. Success to you. Success to those who help you. For your God will help you. David received them and made them rulers of his raiding bands. Some of the men of Manasseh defected to David when he went with the Philistines to fight against Paul. He and his band did not help the Philistines because after consultation, their rulers sent them away. They said, it will cost us our heads to defeat your master Saul. When David went to Ziklag, these were the men of Manasseh who defected to him. Adnah, Jozabad, Thiel, Michael, Bad, Elihu, Zelitha, leaders of units of 1,000 in Manasseh. They helped David against raiding bands, for all of them were brave warriors, and they were commanders in his army. Day after day, men came to help David. Until he had a great army like the army of God. These are the numbers of the men armed for battle who came to David at Hebron to turn Saul's kingdom over to him, as the Lord had said. Men of Judah carrying shield and spear, 6,800 armed for battle. Simeon, warriors ready for battle, 7,100. Now Levi, 4,600, including Jehoiada, leader of the family of Aaron, with 3,700 men, and Zadok, a brave young warrior, with 22 officers from his family. Men of Benjamin, Saul's kinsmen, 3,000, most of whom had remained loyal to Saul's house until then. Now Ephraim, brave warriors, famous in their own clans, 28,800. Men of half tribe of Manasseh, designated by name to come and make David king, 18,000. Men of Issachar, who understood the times and knew what Israel's 200 chiefs, all their relatives. Men of Zebulun, experienced soldiers prepared for battle with every type of weapon to help David, undivided loyalty, 50,000. Men of Naphtali, 1,000 officers together with 37,000 men carrying shields and spears. Men of Dan, ready for battle, 28,600. Men of Asher, experienced soldiers ready, prepared for battle, 40,000. And from east of the Jordan, men of Reuben, Gad, and the half-tribe of Manasseh, armed with every type of weapon, 120,000. All these were fighting men who volunteered to serve in the ranks. They came to Hebron fully determined to make David king over all Israel. All the rest of the Israelites were also of the mind to make David king. Men spent 3 days there with David, eating and drinking, for their families had supplied provisions for them. Also, their neighbors from as far away as Issachar, Zebulun, and Naphtali came bringing food on donkeys, camels, mules, and oxen. There were plentiful supplies, flour, fig cakes, raisin cakes, wine, oil, cattle, and sheep, for there was joy in Israel.
Quite an army.
That they were the ones that were going to make him the king, this is saying, right?
They were traitors.
Basically, but they were that they knew that David was destined to be king. So they were falling behind him. I'm sure that Yahweh turned their hearts, right? They believed Samuel the prophet and knew whose side God was on.
That's the difference between a traitor and a patriot, is who wins.
Right, exactly. Well, that's the way it is, right? That's the difference between a terrorist and a hero.
We'd have lost the American Revolution. Our forefathers would have been...
They'd have been hung as terrorists and traitors, right.
That's one thing that we don't really think about, at least a lot of times when we read these lists. These guys, you know, they were having to go in all the way and go home after this.
I was talking the other night. I forget who I was talking to. I think I was having a private conversation with Carolyn Yeager, and I was talking about John Hancock and Sam Adams, and they fled the British and went to Lexington, and the men of Lexington got their guns and defended them against the British, right? Well, today the men of Lexington would all point them up. There they are. They're hiding over there in that barn. Go get them, and they go back to their bar stools or their television sets.
That's one thing that the leaders of our so-called country now, you know, they're real good at. They indoctrinate children very young and swear allegiance and. You know, that we all were taught that patriotism didn't have to do with the word patriot, you know, with our race and our heritage. It had to do with our country, with our geographical.
Right. And that's the mistake we've always made, is to fall out of the race thing and into geography and pick allegiances by our geography.
They still do it today. You know, if you ever go around to these places that, you know, Don and I go like to Pigeon Forge occasionally and the Branson and things like that and watch them shows. you know, the show's all learned real early on. That all you had to do was fly that flag over the top of it and sing a patriotic song, boy, and you'd have everybody on your feet and clapping. And you know, no matter what the kind of what kind of terrible thing we're doing with our armed forces and all, we still, you know, of course, you know, everybody wants to support the kids, but nevertheless.
The most horrible crime, I think, is to watch a bunch of white guys in a bar rooting on a nigger in a boxing match when he's fighting against an Irishman just because he's got a red, white, and blue trunks on.
Yeah.
See it all the time. Why are you rooting for that nigger? You want him to beat up that white guy? That's crazy.
Well, it's LSU against Alabama and the LSU down there at quarterback. I pulled that.
Who are you taking a low blow at there, Don?
I thought that was funny when they got beat.
Yeah, well, people do it all the time. It's all about geography. Like Clifton likes to say, we can't be patriotic together without a common patriarch. It's that simple. No common patriarch? Well, you go back to wherever the hell you came from and you'd be a patriot there.
So we got a near quarterback for LSU, that's reason we lost. We got a near quarterback running the United States. That's the reason we're losing now.
I don't think we're losing. It might be, though. Mm-hmm. 13. David consulted with the captains of thousands and hundreds and with every leader, and David said unto all the congregation of Israel, if it seem good unto you, and that it be of Yahweh our God, let us send abroad unto our brethren everywhere that are left in the land of Israel, and with them also to the priests and the Levites, which are in the cities and the suburbs, that they may gather themselves unto us. And let us bring again the ark of our God to us, for we inquire not of it in the days of Saul. And all the congregation said that they would do so, for the thing was right in the eyes of all the people. So David gathered all Israel together from Shihor of Egypt unto the entering of Hamath to bring the ark of God from Kiriath-Jearim. And David went up and all Israel to Baalah, with that is to Kiriath-Jearim, which belonged to Judah, to bring up thence the ark of God Yahweh, that dwelleth between the cherubims, whose name is called on it. And they carried the ark of God in a new cart out of the house of Abinadab, and Uzzah and Ahio drave the cart. And David and all Israel played before God with all their might, and with singing, with harps, and with palistries, cymbals, and with trumpets. And when they came to the threshing floor, Uzzah put forth his hand to hold the ark, for the ox had stumbled. And the anger of Yahweh was kindled against Uzzah, and he smote him because he put his hand to the ark, and there he died before Yahweh, before God. And David was displeased because Yahweh had made a breach upon Uzzah, wherefore that place is called Perez Uzzah to this day. And David was afraid of God that day, saying, how shall I bring the ark of God home to me? So David brought not the ark home to himself to the city of David, but carried it aside unto the house of Obed-Edom the Gittite. And the ark of God remained with the family of Obed-Edom in his house 3 months. Yahweh blessed the house of Obed-Edom and all that he had.
Witchcraft, I don't like that. It talks about playing music.
Well, that's Old Testament there.
Yeah.
Well, I always thought that the death of Uzzah was cause and effect, right? That the ark, that he was electrocuted.
Do you think the ark had capacitance?
Well, that's what I believe. Yes, it was built to have capacitance, so that it could contain the aura, which represented God, which isn't, I don't believe that the aura itself is God, it's something that represented God, that it could hold that force.
Yeah.
And that's, I believe it was constructed that way. I'm not an electrician, but that's what I believe. And that's why it had wooden handles that slid through, that it could be carried, and the wood could be safely held, that slid through the eyelets.
Well, we're definitely not given all the construction details of the ark, so, you know, it's possible.
Well, it's basically two layers of metal wrapped around a box of wood, right?
Yeah, but the mercy seat up on top was a solid piece of gold, you know, and if it overlapped to the inside and outside, it would have shorted across the, you know, the insulator. But it's like I say, we're not given all the details, so.
No, we don't have every detail. Right, you're right.
Right, you know, there's a lot of things you couldn't take the description in the Bible of the ark and build it, because you don't know how thick the wood was or how, you know, all of the details of it.
Well, that's true of just about anything in the Bible. A lot's left to guess at. But if you understood electricity and perhaps you could build something that is a capacitor that is built after what we do know about the ark, right? I always believed that it was a giant capacitor, and when Uzzah touched it, he meant well. God didn't strike him dead for being bad, but being struck dead was a natural result of touching it when they were told not to touch it.
So when they quit working on it, building it.
Well, if it was capacitor, it would have to be charged. You know, it would take static electricity, it'd take storms and weather, and of course, you know, being gold. Like I say, if the inside plating and the outside plating didn't connect anywhere with as a conductor, it would definitely store charge. It would definitely charge.
Well, that's how I always envisioned a rational explanation for the death of Uzzah, right?
Well, let's build one.
Okay.
It got expensive.
Yeah, you got all that gold weighing around. Maybe we'll beat your pickup truck out into a gold plate.
We'll have to go find some Jews. They got all the gold. If you happen to find the ark, you can't look at it, because you see what happened on Indiana Jones when they opened that thing up.
Yeah.
Spirits come out of that thing.
Well, where do you think the ark is?
Now let me say that the that this man's name at the end, it was blessed by God, Obed-Edom, right? Well, Obed means servant. Yeah, you know, David's grandfather was named Obed. That means servant, and Obed-Edom means servant of Edom. Well, this man was a Levite. Why would he be named servant of Edom? And let me just say that the Septuagint has Abed-Daram or Abed-Aram, which would be servant of Aram, right? And not servant of Edom. And that seems to be another place, and Clifton's listening tonight, so I hope he makes a note of this. That seems to be another place where Edom and Aram are confused.
That makes good sense.
Because Obed-Edom here is Abed-Aram, A-R-A-M, in the Septuagint.
Park that, Randy?
I don't know.
Well, I'm referring to Deuteronomy 23:7, which Clifton, you know, and I believe it's absolutely right, has exhibited that that's very easily an error for Aram. Thou shalt not abhor an Aromi, which would be Assyrian in English, right? And not an Edomite.
It would
so in the Septuagint, It's Abedara, but it's Abed Aram, Abeddaram, in 1 Chronicles 13:14. So that substantiates, it helps to substantiate the confusion over those letters and the possible confusion over those letters at Deuteronomy 23:7. And there's other evidences of it, but I've never seen another. I've seen other instances where the D and the R are confused in Scripture. Genesis chapter 10, it happened a few times, and it's evident elsewhere. But this is the only other place I've seen where Edom and Aram are definitely confused, right?
I'd not be confused in Deuteronomy 23. A Jew might have put it in there on purpose.
Well, yeah, you're right. A Jew probably read it that way on purpose.
Yeah.
That Daleth and that Resh, that D and R in Hebrew in those block letters, they're not the original Hebrew letters. The D and the R and the V are all very easily mistaken for one another. The Vav, the Resh, and the Daleth. Yeah, this guy isn't no servant of Edom. He's a Levite. He's an Israelite. He's a servant of Aram. It is his name, Obed Aram.
In chapter 14,
the Native Time with artwork.
Nobody. You think he would have survived this long, you think?
I think he's in heaven myself. Doesn't it say the ark will come back down?
It says someplace in Revelation that the temple was opened in heaven and that was the ark.
Yeah, you know something? What did the ark hold in ancient times? It held the tablets of the law, right?
The law and the
ark. When I gave my Revelation exhibition, in Revelation chapter 10... You see the prophecy of the angel coming down from heaven and the opening of the little book, right? And that's the Reformation. And then in Revelation chapter 11, you see the two witnesses. Well, the Roman Catholics tried to stop the little book from opening, and the two witnesses are Israel and Judah during the time of the Fifth Lateran Council and the time of Bloody Mary. And both of those lasted 3.5 years, right? And the opening of the little book was almost prevented, but the two witnesses prevailed, and the Reformation was successful. Then, although the Roman Catholic Church almost prevented the Reformation was successful, and at the end of Revelation chapter 11, you see that the Ark of God is opened in heaven. Heaven is the society of the children of Israel, and the Ark of God is the Bible that holds his law and his word. With the Reformation success, we had a guarantee that we would have Bibles in our houses. If the Reformation didn't succeed, we would not have the word of God today. We would not have Bibles in our houses.
Well, you know, the as well as the law, it also contained Aaron's rod, which is a picture of election. It's, you know, a picture of the idea that his rod budded to show that he was to be also the manna, which, you know, in a sense, being as the law is in the hearts of Israel, as well as the written word, the ark represents society, the society of Israel in itself, having an election, having law, and having the bread of God, you know, in their hearts. Another thing, too, with the physical box, if the plates on the inside and the outside weren't overlapped all the way with gold, then it would be, the wood between it would have been subject to elements, which probably wouldn't have been able to survive, you know, for that long. I kind of doubt that the physical box exists still. Probably been melted down or something a long time ago.
Well, according to two Maccabees, it's buried in a certain cave, you know, in Transjordania. Mount Nebo, right where Moses was buried. Wasn't it Mount Nebo? It might be some other mountain. It's I forget exactly. I'd have to look at Clifton's website. Mount Nebo was the mountain from which the curses were back in Judges, right, were uttered.
Black Israelites got it on an island in the middle of Nile.
well, the thing about that, you know, there's some validity to that, right? It's not validity concerning the ark that was the Israelite ark in Jerusalem, right? But there's a this papyri, if you ever look up the Elephantine papyri, right? The Elephantine papyri actually contain letters from the island of Elephantine written to the Persian governance, you know, of the empire in the Persian period. And they were asking for permission to build a replica of the temple so that they could worship. Evidently, a whole bunch of people, of men who were soldiers, and they brought their families, right? Elephantine was the southernmost outpost of the empire, and they were working as mercenaries for the Persians, and they moved to Elephantine, and that's where they were stationed. So they wanted to build a duplicate temple. This is right around the time of Ezra and Nehemiah. It's a parallel. We don't read about it in the Bible because it has nothing to do with the scripture, right? But these papyri have been found, and they are 2,500 years old. So that these men want to build a duplicate temple, and they're granted permission to do so. Now, that temple didn't last very long, all right? It was destroyed after not much time. It was probably gone by the time of Alexander. It didn't last long at all. I forget how long exactly. But, you know, if they built a duplicate temple, they would have had to have built a duplicate Ark of the Covenant. And if they built a duplicate ark, and if the Ethiopians, who these men eventually, that they all mingled together, right, and they made nigger Jews, is what they made. And if they maintain that ark for all that time, and that ark does exist, it has to be the ark from that duplicate temple. They must have somehow made a replica of the ark, or at least what they thought would be a replica of the ark, if they made a duplicate temple. And the Elephantine papyri shows that they did make a duplicate temple. So I think that if the Ethiopians have an ark, that is how they have it. And it's not, of course it's not real, but that's what they have. If indeed they have it at all.
Saxon Jews.
Well, yeah, and that's where those Jews came from. And aside from that, a whole lot of Jews went down to Arabia and into those regions after the time of Theodosius I and Theodosius II, because they had to leave the Byzantine Empire, that they couldn't act like Jews anymore in the Byzantine Empire.
A box of pure gold, you'd have to have something in the middle, wouldn't you?
Well, it wasn't a pure gold, it was overlaid. It was a wooden box overlaid. The top was pure, but the structure of the box itself was a wooden structure that was overlaid top and, you know, inside and out. It would have capacitance to it if the rim of the box wasn't overlaid where the inside and outside would touch.
I'd settle for just
the
top.
Yeah, I bet you would. You know how much that thing had to weigh? I wouldn't have wanted to tow it around very long.
Especially when I told you to go across that creek, you know, and remember when we were going across, I didn't do it. And you know, I waded all across it, remember?
Yeah.
We wondered where it is. The Jews, you got to have it. They got all the gold.
Yeah, actually, it is Mount Nebo. The two Maccabees says Jeremiah hid the ark at Mount Nebo. Now, I don't know if that's 100% reliable or not, but That's what 2 Maccabees says.
We got Lake Nebo right up here. Maybe
right. Down Jamestown.
If it still exists, it's in the basement of the Vatican.
I think Mount Nebo. Mount Nebo is where the curses were uttered from in the ancient kingdom, wasn't it? the blessings and the curses? And the blessings were uttered from Heriman or Ebal, and the curses were uttered from Nebo? Does that...
I think Moses died on Mount Nebo.
Okay, Jan. Chapter 14. Now Hiram, king of Tyre, sent messengers to David and timber of cedars with masons and carpenters to build him a house. And David perceived that the Lord had confirmed him king over Israel, for his kingdom was lifted up on high because of his people Israel. David took more wives at Jerusalem, and David begat more sons and daughters. These are the names of his children which he had in Jerusalem: Shemua, Shobab, Nathan, and Solomon, and Ithar, and Elisha, and Elpalet, and Noga, and Nepheg, and Japhia, Elishama, and Belada, and Eliphelet. And when the Philistines heard that David was anointed king over all Israel, all the Philistines went up to seek David. David heard of it and went out against them. The Philistines came and spread themselves in the valley of Rephaim. And David inquired of God, saying, "Shall I go up against the Philistines? And wilt thou deliver them into my hand?" And the Lord said unto him, "Go up, for I will deliver them into thine hand."
So now this is what true humility is, right? True humility isn't bowing before men. And true humility is inquiring of God and seeking to do the things that God wants a man to do, right? David had true humility. He didn't, in his pride as king, just rush out to face the Philistines. He inquired of God.
They came up to Baal Perazim, and David smote them there. Then David said, "God hath broken in upon mine enemies in mine hand like the breaking forth of water." For they called the name of that place Baal Perazim. And they had left their gods there. David gave a commandment, and they were burned with fire. The Philistines yet again spread themselves abroad in the valley. Therefore David inquired again of God, and God said unto him, "Go not up after them, turn away from them, and come up them over against the mulberry trees. It shall be, when thou shalt hear a sound of going in the tops of mulberry trees, then thou shalt go out to battle, for God has gone forth before thee to smite the host of the Philistines." David therefore did as God commanded him, and they smote the host of the Philistines from Gibeon even to Gezer. Fame of David went out into all lands, and the Lord brought the fear of him upon all nations.
Do any of y'all know where the tradition that the Masons used to say that the architect Hiram was raised from the dead originated?
I think it probably originated with some Jew in the 1400s or 1500s, right? That'd be my guess.
So you're not trying to match it up to the widow's son that Elijah raised.
I don't know. I don't get, you know, most of that Mason stuff to me is just pure bull. It's stuff that they made up that really, just because they use some similarities with the Bible, doesn't mean that those stories can be extended back to the Bible, right?
Oh, yeah. They don't go near back that far, but they, you know, they teach these traditions orally, and it seems that, I know it's an important tradition to them. I thought that maybe that they tried to tie it into, you know, one of the sons of the widow that Elijah was at. I used to try to figure out the time frame, and it didn't seem to match up to me.
Well, Elijah is at least 400 years after the architect Hiram, right? Elijah the prophet, you're talking about the time of Ahab, right? It's probably more like 250 years. I'm going to go see. Ahab is he died in 853, and that's when Elijah, you know, when Ahab and Jezebel died, that's when Elijah was extant. That's at least 100. That's about 150 years after the time of Hiram the architect.
Yeah, that's more like what I was coming up with. It didn't.
Yeah, not as long as I thought, but it's a long time.
Yeah, it's too long to be the same. And I, you know, but you know, they got these blessed is the widow's son or whatever they say to each other, you know, all of that stuff. I just.
Well, to me, it's all Jewish fables, right? That whole masonry thing that they borrow these Bible stories and they twist them into something that they could propagate through masonry to make their little sect members happy that this is some sort of ancient tradition and it's really some medieval Jew bullshit.
Read that book by Albert Pike?
Stigmas and Dogmas? I perused it, kind of.
He's got the book. Me and him looked at it.
I got the book too.
You ain't got this book.
They think it was I was resurrected. Remember?
Yeah, he's that's what I
had. He was the one that had the holy word, or in search of the word that he left there. Certain degrees of masons, they went to get him, but they couldn't resurrect him. He was found dead. Remember?
Yeah.
And as they tried to resurrect him, he came all to pieces. And they had to keep moving up.
Got somebody knew the name.
And you know, that's their deal is a search of more light.
Mm-hmm.
And yet, every one of their place, they block all the windows, and you know. and they all say they're Christians. When we all know that Jesus Christ is the light. You know, you can't have more light. If you're looking for light.
Yeah, that's the first thing that they make you do. And what I can read on it, anyways. They make you bow before their altar and admit that you're in complete darkness and you need the light of masonry in your life. Now, in other words, they make you denounce Yeshua, but being the light of the world, and they make you announce that you're in the darkness and you need their light.
No, church is kind of.
Yeah, well, same thing, huh?
When you go to the altar, you know, say the sinner's prayer, and admit you're in darkness.
Then you got to give them a dollar and light a candle to get the light.
Yeah.
Yeah, well, you're right, Randy. That's totally Antichrist.
Yeah.
No doubt.
Yeah, you know, the first thing, if you read in the front of their Bibles, it talks about the lambskin they wear, and it'll tell you that the lambskin is a representation of their righteous works, without which you don't enter into the presence of the holy architect of the universe. So they're that's a Jew religion. That's a work of salvation.
Right. No doubt.
Look up an antique store?
Yeah.
I got a buddy, and he told me that landscape is his. That is number one thing with him. That's his most prized possession.
If you go to one of their funerals and they have the Masonic funeral, they say all sorts of things that are strictly against Christianity.
Yeah. Well, Albert Pike, he worships Satan anyway. And Lucifer is our God.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. They don't want the regular guys to know it.
Well, you got to be way up there to get that
thing. It's in his writings.
Yeah. Yeah.
I read it.
Lucifer the Morning Star.
In my book.
Mm-hmm.
We
ain't got this book.
Well, it doesn't matter what God you profess with your mouth. What matters is what God you profess with your actions, right?
Right.
And they could say Jesus all day long, but if they're not obedient to Scripture, then they're not followers of Christ.
I was invited to... you know, the first Shriners Hospital ever built was built here in Shreveport, Louisiana, in 1922. And, of course, I was out there from 1941 to 1954. And they tore down the old hospital, and they built a big, fine new one. And they had had the 75th anniversary of the Shriners Hospital, and I was invited to go and participate in the program because I was a survivor, and I went. And so I went through that entire hospital trying to find any evidence of Christ. They've got everything in the world there, but they do not have any reference to Christ, nor in any of the prayers they did during that ceremony or speeches or anything else did they mention or call upon the name of Christ. It was the supreme architect of the universe and God, and that was all. And all the prayers that they did not end in Christ's name. They never mentioned the word Christ.
Well, that's a Baal religion, right? I mean, supreme architect of the universe could be anything to anybody. God can be anything to anybody. That's why I use the name Yahweh, because I'm making damn sure people know exactly what God I'm talking about.
That's what I tell everybody, too. Different God.
It's not our God.
That's what seems, you know, when they use God, you know, they may be telling the truth about their God, you know.
I just like these Jews guys. They're more loyal to their God than we are. You look at our God, you know.
Yeah.
They stick with you, know, but they're against you.
Well, you know, the Masonic Lodge is just like a lot of the denominational teachings, you know. It's just, it preys upon a man's pride. You know, Dr. Bill's talking about with true humility, but a man's pride wants to save himself. He wants to be worthy of grace. He wants to be, you know, acceptable because of something he's done or he's doing. And that basically is every church out there. You know, they tell you that Yahshua died in order that, you know, if you do the right thing, and we tell you, if you do what we say, then you can be saved because he died. Well, you know, that's a little bit cockeyed there. It doesn't make sense.
Well, we don't do works to be saved. We're saved, and for that reason, we do good works.
Right.
Period.
That's right.
The basis of the Shriners, they do such good works.
If you can look at your,
they really do.
If you can look at your Israelite brother, and you can tell him that he's completely lost and undone, unless he does what you tell him to do in order to become saved, you have committed blasphemy. And that's what all churches do. That's what the Masonic Lodge does. But it appeals to the man's pride. You know, I've done my duty. You know, I've became worthy because of something I've done. And it's impossible. You can't be worthy of grace. If you are, then it isn't grace.
Yeah.
Well, in that case, niggers could be saved.
That's the whole problem, Bill, right there. That's because if you can do something, if you can be undone one day, and if because of your actions you can become whole, then anyone who's able to do those same actions can do it also.
That's why work salvation leads right to universalism.
That's right. That's exactly.
Because then people say, well, look at that Negro. He's being good. He does this. He does that. Well, that's, you know, that's all well and good, but that ain't going to buy him a ticket to heaven.
That's the reason what Eli is teaching is universalism for that very reason.
Absolutely. Eli brought it right out in his program last January with Sword Brother, and he said if a Canaanite, you know, if somebody had 10 or 15% Canaanite and they led good lives and they never hurt anybody, that then they could be saved. Well, no, they can't be.
If you don't do that, you might well forget what we teach.
If you throw one Israelite into the lake of fire, the word of God comes to naught. I don't know if you heard my program on this past Saturday, but I did the Heirs of the Covenant paper. I got online, I presented that, and then I went into an exhibition of all Israel being saved and comparing John chapter 15, I am the vine and you are the branches. Well, that's a racial parable because the same John tells us in 1 John chapter 3 that if our seed is in us, we can't sin. And that's, it boils all down to race and nothing else.
Well, you know that if Yahweh made one cowl of wrath fit for destruction out of a lump of clay, and he made one child of the kingdom out of the same lump of clay. He has to accept both of them because of the same lump of clay. Because if you're not, then he's unrighteous.
Well, right, and that's why Paul said, "Who are you, old man, to be arguing
here
against
the Paul matter?" Paul addressed it plainly, don't he?
You know, does the pot ask
that argument
make,
this
why
week?
Did you make me this way?
The same lump, boy. That's where he kept going back to. It's the same lump.
Yeah, I argued with a preacher out of Florida about a year ago. It's James Knox. He's real famous on TV. All Presbyterian, no, Baptist preaching. He is trying to say it wasn't no such thing as predestined, or he really preached against Calvin's belief. You know what you?
Yeah.
Well, some of the Baptists believe, some don't. Some of the Baptists are stupid. They don't know what to do believe. But anyway.
Well, the bottom line is that predestination is not Calvinism. Predestination, which is explicitly mentioned by Paul, comes from God.
Yeah.
And as soon as somebody says, oh, that's Calvinism, you got to tell them right up front, no, it's not. It's Yahwehism. It's Christianity.
Well, they give John Calvin a bad time about that, though. They ain't Baptist, boy. Some of them don't like that.
Yeah, well, Calvin was only addressing the Catholic Church and its work salvation.
Yeah.
But that's the problem they have with it, too.
Yeah.
Well, which I rather call sacramentalism, because that's what it is, right? But work salvation and sacramentalism are one and the same thing. They're just synonyms.
Well, you make a Baptist mad quick, mention John Calvin. They don't like John Calvin.
Well, no, because they want to think that they save you by baptizing you. That's why they call themselves Baptists.
Oh, they save you because you're accepting Jesus as your personal Savior.
You got to accept him, is what they say, the Baptist.
Well, even the devils know there is one God and they tremble. Even the demons knew that he was the Son of God and that he was the Christ. I mean, but that doesn't mean that they were saved. So that acceptance thing, there's about five scriptures that throw that right out the window real easy.
Go to the domestic church and you get sprinkled. Or immersed. They can do it both ways.
It depends on how much money you have. Want the full chassis or just the lube, John?
Do we have time to do another chapter? Or?
Yeah.
Okay, well, who's next?
If we're going in turns, I'm going to just
Well, let me say that Jerusalem, I was looking for a passage before. I know I got it written about somewhere on my website. I wrote about it for a program. Joab was able to take the city of David, was able to take Jerusalem very quickly. And there's an indication in Samuel that Joab actually was able to use what was later called Hezekiah's tunnel to breach where there was a spring of water, and they used to lower a bucket down from the city through this tunnel into the spring to get it filled with water. And that was how David took Jerusalem so easily, right?
Yeah, the Hezekiah's conduit or tunnel, yeah.
Yeah, they had aquifer all in front of them.
He was able to go in through that way and go up into the city and take the citadel right away.
I wonder how they got the sewage out of the city, if it was sitting on top of this aquifer without contaminating their water. You think about how many people were there and being on top of the mountain and being on top of that aquifer like that.
Right. Yeah, you know, the Romans had running sewers that they had water brought into all their cities through the viaducts, right, through the aquifers, and they built very elaborate plumbing. Well, that's not original to Rome, right? It's the archaeology of the island of Crete shows that in 2000 B.C. they had systems like that.
Well, that's one of the things about Israelites, you know, they were always taught about the problems to do with raw sewage. You know, they were to cover up what came from them, you know.
And right.
I expect that they knew really early on the problems with living within, you know, fluids.
Right. Well, it's very likely that as early as 2000 BC, we were building systems to remove sewage from cities.
That's very reason them cats is Israelites. They got the law in their heart. They're buried.
Chapter 15. After David had constructed buildings for himself in the city of David, he prepared a place for the ark of God and pitched a tent for it. Then David said, "No one but the Levites may carry the ark of God, because the Lord chose them to carry the ark of the Lord and to minister before him forever." David assembled all Israel in Jerusalem to bring up the ark of the Lord to the place he had prepared for it. He called together the descendants of Aaron and the Levites. From the descendants of Kohath, Uriel, the leader, and 120 relatives. From the descendants of Merari, Ahaziah, leader, and 220 relatives. From the descendants of Gershon, Joel, leader, and 130 relatives.
Yeah, you got one of those women's lib Bibles, don't you? But because everywhere it says descendants in the Hebrew, it says sons. And everywhere where it says relatives in the Hebrew, it says brethren, right? It sounds like your Bible just wants to make the world safe for feminists or something. I just thought I'd throw that out there.
from the descendants of Ishaphon, Shemaiah, the leader, and 200 relatives. From the descendants of Hebron, Eliel, and the leader, and 80 relatives. From the descendants of Uzzel, Amminadab, the leader, and 112 relatives. Then David summoned Zadok and Abiathar, the priests, and Uriel, Ahaziah, Joel, and Shemaiah, Eliel, and Amminadab, the Levites. He said to them, "You are the heads of the Levitical families. You and your fellow Levites are to consecrate yourselves and bring up the ark of the Lord, the God of Israel, to the place I have prepared for it. It was because you, the Levites, did not bring it up the first time that the Lord our God broke out in anger against us. We did not inquire of him about how to do it in the prescribed way." So the priests and Levites consecrated themselves in order to bring up the ark of the Lord, God of Israel. Levites carried the ark of God with the poles on their shoulders, as Moses had commanded, in accordance with the word of the Lord. David told the leaders of the Levites to appoint their brothers as singers to sing joyful songs, accompanied by musical instruments, lyres, harps, and cymbals. So the Levites appointed Heman, son of Joel, his brothers, Asaph, son of Berechiah, and from their brothers, the Merarites, Ethan, son of Cushiah, and with them, their brothers next in rank, Zechariah, Jeiel, Shemiramoth, Hilo, Una, Maasiah, Shiva, Eli, Neil, Obed, Edom, and Jael, the gatekeepers. Physicians Heman, Asaph, and Ethan were to sound bronze cymbals. Zechariah, Aziel, Miramoth, Tua, Eleph, Asiah, and Benaiah were to play the lyres according to Alamoth, Atahiah, Eliph, that far? Or it just says it again?
That just says it again.
Mignai, Gael, and Azaziah were to play the harps, directing according to Eminem. Kenaniah, the head Levite, was in charge of the singing. That was his responsibility because he was skillful at it. Berechiah and Elkaniah were to be doorkeepers for the ark. Zebaniah, Josaphat, Nathaniel, Amasa, Uriah, Benaiah, the priest, were to blow trumpets before the ark of God. Obed-Edom and Jehiah were also to be doorkeepers for the ark. So David and the elders of Israel and the commanders of units of 1,000 went up to bring up the ark of the covenant of the Lord from the house of Obed-Edom with rejoicing because God had helped the Levites who were carrying the ark of the covenant of the Lord. 7 bulls and 7 rams were sacrificed. Now David was clothed in a robe of fine linen for all the Levites who were carrying the ark. And as were the singers and Kenaniah, who was in charge of the singing of the choirs, David also wore a linen ephod. So all Israel brought up the ark of the covenant of the Lord with shouts, with the sounding of rams, horns, and trumpets, and of cymbals, and the playing of lyres and harps. As the Ark of the Covenant of the Lord was entering the city of David, Michael, daughter of Michal, daughter of Saul, watched from a window. And when she saw King David dancing and celebrating, she despised him in her heart.
Yeah, you know that Michal is spelled differently, but it's Michael, right? It's the same Hebrew word. Who is like God. They just spelled it differently on purpose because I guess it's a woman. They left the E out for some reason. Do you think, Randy, God punished Michal by having her later separated from David?
Oh, yeah. I do. I think you can't get away with that without, you know, at least there's a cause there. Peace. Well supported.
Therefore, in 2 Samuel 6:23, it says, therefore, Michal, the daughter of Saul, had no child under the day of her death. She was left barren.
That's to be learned for all you women.
And this is the only other time she's mentioned in Scripture after 2 Samuel chapter 21.
She was probably pretty spoiled. Oh, she was Saul's daughter, right?
That's right.
You know, so she
was raised by a king. Yeah. King. All the other girls out there, all that going on, you know.
Uh-huh.
He was out dancing. Put away.
I think a woman should support her husband. You know, that's one of the great sins of women today is they'll go ask their preacher, they'll go talk to their preacher about their husband without their husband there, and the preacher will do it. You know, the preacher will counsel a woman without her husband there. Man, he ought to be took out and hung.
Something like that. There's a couple old gals that go up there for my wife to go to church. Go to the war, you know how they talk to you. If you can't answer your wife's question, then you go to a group with her. You know where you are, and get that. They'll just like you say, discuss it. They'll act like you're crazy.
There's there's millions of Israelite men in this country who know there's something wrong with denominational churches. And they don't know why they know it. They just know it, and they know it, what's going on is not right. And these feminist women get in there, and, you know, they let them go to church, first of all, without them. They shouldn't do that. If they're convinced something's wrong, they shouldn't let their wives be there either. But, you know, they let them go to them churches without them, and, you know, they'll get up there and pray with the preacher for their husbands and stuff like that. That ain't nothing but that's a form of adultery, if you ask me.
You know, Oral Roberts' son got caught drunk driving 93 miles an hour this weekend, didn't he? Yeah, he got arrested.
Well, what's that got to do with anything?
Yeah, you know, most most of these men are happy to see their wives get the hell out of the house. That's why they're happy to have them go to church. Yeah, you know, they're happy that their wives get out of their hair for a couple of hours. They'd probably send them to church all week if they could.
Yeah, but the preachers have much fault in it, though, Bill, if you ask me. You know, that they should know better. They should know better than counseling, you know, a woman without her husband there.
Well, that's absolutely true.
There's a little place up there where we grew up now. And those, most of them got wet, the men are dead. But even when they wasn't, I knew them. And the women control the money. And they control that church. And not very many are there. But if you'll think about that, in most places, that's the way it is.
Mm-hmm.
These men usually, they're going to, the men don't want to rock the boat.
That's because they've been effeminized. They had no stones any longer. That's exactly, that's what the enemy wants. You know, they don't want any of David's mighty men around anymore.
If you're a man that stands up for what you believe in, you're seen as being a mean person.
Hateful.
You're a cretin. You're a barbarian. You're everything vile, right?
Well, that depends on your race. You stand up for what you believe in, and you're black, you're admired. You know, look at what they did with Martin Luther King, who actually did nothing, you know. But he, you know, he was for his race, you know. So he was a great leader. Have a white person do it.
I mean, he had a bunch of women.
Yeah.
He had a couple of men.
Well, that's what they do.
At different times.
But yeah, you know, it's a double standard there, I guarantee you.
Yeah, just like in Shreveport. A black junior, I belong to the Chamber of Commerce, Houston. They have a black Chamber of Commerce, they have a black Miss Shreveport, they have a black Miss America, they got all the old Ebony newspaper, solid black. You try that crap, huh? They have a black day and all that stuff. Just go through.
Oh, we fix out Black History Month in February, man, a whole month long. Might as well shut your TV off if you ever watch it.
You know, if you'd hire a black to work for you and then run your business, you'd get a lot more money.
Yeah, that's an oxymoron.
Put your business in his name so that you get the status for the, you know.
You know what an oxymoron is? A nigger at work. In the same you show him what it will, and he'll hire him. When they quit growing cotton.
Yeah, we're the only race that can't have anything to do with white. Hey, they're trying to stop that pipeline on account of the Koch brothers. Yeah, I saw something.
Hey, that's what? Koch brothers ain't even affiliated with the pipeline. But they won't bring them in and question them and see if they are. Because they're rich. They can
rich. All of this is our fault. Oh, yeah.
It is our fault for tolerating that crap. Because as long as we have our, like you and I were talking, everybody got money in their pocket, so they don't want to rock the boat. Everybody's okay. You know, we're all cool. But one of these days, that crap's going to hit the fan.
But I still say it's going to be much worse on them than it is on you.
Oh, no doubt. No doubt. We win. I read the back of the book. You know, we win.
Well,
our people don't know it.
Even when the monetary system falls apart, it may take a little while to get going. But they'll always be bartering, and they'll always, and you'll get that parasite out of your back pocket.
In the last month, my family and a bunch of you were together, and we discussed a little bit here. My people had big houses. They had as good as anything was going on. Somebody had a job for money. Do what they had. He grew one thing, you grew something else, and this is back in the 40s. And they changed that stuff. And everybody had way plenty to eat, and everybody worked.
It'll be the best thing that ever happened for the relations between Israelites when that does happen. Because you alone, then you'll have to depend on your brethren. Now we just think we, you know, we're an island, we're isolated. But you get to where you have to trust and depend on somebody, you know, even if it's just for protection in groups and things like that.
This old guy, you go right back by his house. Go my old buddy the Hermit, I hadn't been up there in a long time. That old house has fallen down where McCoy lives up there. Yeah. I used to go pick him up all the time. And he's told me, he said, he had the angels of 1,000 masons looking after him. And I said, they ain't doing too good. You got 4 Joes going over hauling your ass around. And you got 1,000 masons looking at you. You ain't doing too good, buddy. You know, and he still went, but I hadn't been up for a
while. How come you hadn't go pick him up if he had all them angels?
We haven't seen him out now.
I see him around there.
You still see him?
Yeah, I see him. I saw him just up
there. Every week I say, I got to get back up there. But I'm a little leery of him. You know, he's a good guy. He's hung up on that crap. And he reads this right here continuously. He reads the Bible continuously.
He don't understand none of it.
No?
He's real smart. I know him. I mean, he can sit down and type out a letter.
Wasn't he an engineer?
Yeah, something.
He was in the military?
Yeah, he worked for Hurricane. Yeah. His daddy was nuts. Just like him. They got something wrong with their brain.
He has no electricity,
no
water.
He ain't gonna win.
Apparently the walls are falling down in his house. Roof's caved in, and he lives in there winter, summer.
Yeah.
And how what he eats and how he survives.
He's very damn good.
Huh?
But when I first met him, was 12-13 years ago, it was 100 degrees like we had last. So I was at work, and I'd drive that big old diesel, go by the office over there, load it up with ice, come get water, come get more raggedy Jeep, get me a couple of beers, go over there. That went on all that. One day he said, "Fool, I appreciate you coming by, but you ain't bring that damn ice no more." He got deep freeze that raggedy ass place. He had a washer and a dryer, and this is the open one to fall out. I ain't gonna have electricity. And I'd carry him to the store, and he'd go to Bushes Arcadia, and son, he'd just load up everything. I mean, all that canned frozen juice stuff, he'd just load up.
He's got electricity in that old thing?
I don't think, he may not have electricity now. Okay. I've been trying to look at that breaker out there, see if it's pulled or something, going back to that. But when I was up there,
he had electricity. I don't think, because I don't ever see no light.
No. You ain't never going to see no light. He had black tar paper across the floor. He'd be able to fund that stuff. He had air conditioner that old place. And I went up and helped him fix a trap. You know, people coming around, he used rat traps as a breaker, and he used flash bulbs that would go off in the middle of the night, and you could tell if somebody come across. But that sucker, son, don't mix it up with him now on this damn. John is talking about that stuff he teaches. Go up and see Mr. McCork. He'll teach him something, because that's when it lives in that place. Don't worry. I'd be worried about rattlesnakes crawling there on me. He ain't worried about nothing.
Well, he's got guns.
I take it to store. He carry a 2 lever action 30-30, 1 infield, a new Browning AR, and a double bag. He loads every damn thing.
You go with him, huh?
He ain't worried about people stealing his crap. He's paranoid about that. He's on guard if y'all walk around.
Yeah, he shot himself one time. Not on purpose.
We'll take Bill by there and
Bill might want to stay a couple of days with
him. Well, Bill learned something about that. That sucker's tough. And he like his electrician, he's very in the, I mean, he's worried about it. He starts talking about shooting, screaming, and all of it. But you can't help with lighting. Help with lighting.
Well, are we through now for the evening? Mark's closed his book, and I'm assuming since he's
been next week.
When did you take over charge?
He's talking about killing that guy when he took that off. What do you call electricity when it jumps across?
An arc.
Maybe that's how I got it.
It could be. It could be. Maybe that's how arc flash was.
Well, Bill, we thank you. We enjoyed it, and we thank all the people that's listening on TeamSpeak, and Lord willing, the creek don't rise. We'll be here next week, and we'll hit it again.
Well, I'll see you next week. Take care and God bless. I'll be on. I'm going to do Hosea on Talk Show tomorrow. I'm going to start Hosea. It'll probably take more than 1 week, right?
Yeah, that's a good book.
Okay, I'll see you later. God bless.
Wow. You want to turn that off? Push the little button there. Yeah.